It's always wonderful to see your faces, especially since I've missed you the last 2 weeks because I was at an 8-day silent Zen meditation retreat. Zen retreat. They don't call it meditation in the Pacific Northwest. And the setting is particularly beautiful and quiet, and the practice is particularly quiet. One might think that all silent meditation is equally silent, but there are many shades of silence. At a Zen retreat, a system of bells and other percussion takes they take the place of the human voice. And you can tell what's next on the schedule just by listening to the bells or the clackers without the need for announcements or talk about what to do next. There's a great emphasis on both protecting the silence and somewhat paradoxically connecting with the community in silence. We receive the instructions to walk slowly, move softly, and of course, I haven't followed this instruction for most of my meditation retreats and even my Zen retreats. And I did find this time that when I slowed down my walking and my movement, it helped to settle down my nervous system. Particularly after the rush and pressure to get ready for the retreat, to wrap up all my work, pack everything I'll need in a remote area, including linens, towels, blankets, sign out all my emails and voicemails, and get to the airport for an early flight. Ironically, I tend to get stressed out preparing for a retreat. This year, we also received the instruction to lower our gaze, not always looking up and reaching outward and ahead with our eyes. For example, our teacher said, say you're in the coffee line in the morning, and in fact, you can still lower your gaze because you really need to see only the person in front of you in order to move up at the right time. And usually, when we're waiting in the coffee line or whatever, wherever we're waiting, we're kind of looking ahead. How long will it take that person at the front of the line to open up the creamer or to decide which bag of tea they're going to drink this morning? And when I heard this instruction and began to follow it, I began to wonder how much time do I spend looking ahead, even in situations where no productive planning or control is possible? How much agitation do I add to my nervous system just by reaching ahead with my eyes and finding things that I find an impulse to correct or change or wish that I can change when there's really nothing I can do but stand patiently in line? And this kind of has become a metaphor for me of how much is my mind reaching out to grapple with sources of agitation or irritation? Is it my mind reaching out? Are these things really bothering me, or am I going out to bother them or be bothered by them? Now, it might sound like a solitary practice when we pass each other on a path, face to face, we bow to each other still with lowered gaze, not making direct eye contact. However, bowing and having someone else take a couple of seconds even to gently bow to you, to really take the time to bow gracefully, in many ways, this feels more connected than what we normally do when we say, hi, how you doing? And we really have no time to hear any answer other than fine. So, despite this lack of verbal communication, there is this great emphasis on connection. We meditate with our eyes softly open so that if someone comes to sit next to us or in front of us, we bow silently. No one in the dining hall starts to eat until everyone has food on their plate, and then we all start together. In the silence, we can feel the presence of someone sitting down to meditate next to us. We can hear if they're breathing fast or slow, if they seem tense or relaxed. And of course, there are the teachings. Now, this year, because of studying Torah here with you, and then hearing commentary and listening to Zen stories, I was struck by a similarity, which is particularly relevant for our parsha this week, Parshat Pinchas, which includes the story of the daughters of Zelophehad. Whether Jewish or Zen, much of our teaching comes from hearing stories, and particularly stories of conversations between a teacher and a student, between two students, between the king and the Buddha, between Hillel and Shammai. Whether Jewish or Zen, the meaning of these stories is often not accessible without commentary, without the interpretation of scholars from different times throughout history who read and reread and reflect from their current perspective on the story. Zen is known for its stories that are apparently impossible to understand, and often their main point is to make us question our assumptions and perceptions. The Zen koan is described as ambiguous and paradoxical, waiting for our minds to open up enough to allow the space for deep intuition to emerge. For us to access, that was a quote from an explanation, but I think of this as accessing our nonverbal wisdom, our openness to holding opposites in mind at the same time, our willingness to give up the idea that people and things are either this or that, or that any meaning can be pinned down. For example, this story about a cup of tea from the Japanese master Nan-in. Nan-in, who lived fairly recently, 1868 to 1912, received a university professor who came to inquire about Zen. Nan-in served tea. He poured his visitor's cup full and then kept on pouring. The professor watched the overflow until he could no longer restrain himself. "It's over full, no more will go in." "Like this cup," Nan-in said, "you are full of your own opinions and speculations. How can I show you Zen unless you first empty your cup?" So the message is nonverbal. It's an action that wakes us up, that jolts us out of our usual perceptions. The understanding comes in a moment of intuition, not analytic thinking. And then, of course, the understanding disappears again, and we need to be jolted again. Hillel also had many dialogues with students. In a familiar dialogue, Hillel, like Nan-in, does not give a direct answer, but directs the student to do a mental exercise to prepare himself for learning. To do the mental exercise and also take action on his own. This famous account in Talmud tells the story of a Roman who decided he wanted to affiliate himself with the Judean sages of the Second Temple. However, he did not have the patience to spend an adequate amount of time immersed in their teaching and literature. So he said he would join them on condition that he could be taught the entirety of the Torah while standing on one foot. The first sage he approached, Shammai, thought the student was not being genuine and chased him away with a measuring stick. The second sage, Hillel, accepted the challenge and stated the following: "That which is hateful to you, you do not do to another. That is the entire Torah. The rest is interpretation. Go study. We usually hear this translated, I think, as the rest is commentary. However, I like the rest is interpretation because it highlights that it's not only like the commentary we read in Torah, in Talmud, I mean. It's the process that we all go through. Whatever we take from spiritual teachings or from anything is filtered through our own interpretation as well as the commentary of others. Sometimes, as our practice matures, we realize that our early interpretations are actually obstacles to our understanding. But Nanin reminds us to empty the teacup, and Hillel reminds us to go back to that intuitive knowing of what we don't want done to us. We know that. That's intuitive. Our nonverbal understanding of how we feel is a critical guide to how we care for others and to our spiritual practice. Whether the conversation is between Nanin and the professor or between Hillel and the Roman, we're reminded over and over that understanding spiritual teachings requires a questioning attitude, a desire to learn, even a challenge, along with a demanding but responsive teacher. It demands an engagement of body, senses, and mind altogether, and a community that supports the practice by struggling with the mystery together. We access spiritual teachings through stories and through relationships with our teachers and fellow students. This week, our parsha includes another story about asking a question. And this time, they do get an answer. The daughters of Zelophehad ask a question of Moses, and Moses in turn asks a question of God. There are many interesting things to learn from these dialogues. But first, let's look at the context in which the question arises. Moses has been plagued by the complaints, the rebellions, the acts of defiance outlined in the past several Torah readings. This week's parsha begins with an act of revenge as Pinchas brutally slays an Israelite man and a Midianite woman who are engaging in the prohibited sexual cult practices of Baal Peor, the local god. This brutal act appears to be rewarded by God, who also, apparently, had no better solution for this problem. God proclaims, the story says, Pinchas has turned my wrath from the Israelites by displaying among them his passion for me so that I did not wipe out the Israelite people in my passion. It sounds as if God is relieved to have Pinchas commit the murder for him, so God did not have to start a plague among the Israelites instead. It's interesting to note that it is not Moses who takes action for God, but someone younger and more on fire, Pinchas. The plague is ended, a detailed census is taken, and we are told at the end of this census that indeed there was not one left of those counted by Moses and Aaron when they recorded the Israelites in the wilderness of Sinai. That means there were not the people who started the journey, the people who had been enslaved in Mitzrayim. They were not left. None of them survived except for Caleb and Joshua and Moses and Aaron. Not one remained, for the Lord had said of them, they shall die in the wilderness. And that was after the episode with the scouts. In the midst of this reckoning with rebellion and recording of losses, we are told a story about five sisters who feel the opposite of fear, dread, or complaint about the promised land. In stark contrast to those who are reluctant or afraid to enter the land, the five sisters want to make sure they get their rightfully owned share of the land. we're told the names of each of these five women, and that they stood before Moses, Eleazar the priest, the chieftains, and the whole assembly, and they told their story. Our father died in the wilderness. He was not of the faction, Korah's faction, banded together against the Lord, but died for his own sin, which is interpreted here as his punishment after the scout episode, the same reason everyone else in that generation died. But he died without any male heirs. Let now our father's name, let not our father's name be lost to his clan, just because he had no son. Give us a holding among our father's kinsmen. Aviva Zornberg offers an illuminating commentary on this, which Yocheved also discussed last year. She notes, Aviva Zornberg notes, that when the women come to Moses with this question, Moses immediately brought their case before the Lord, and the Lord immediately said, "Ken banot zelofchad dovrot." The words of the daughter are right. They have spoken correctly. I'm trying to remember if there is any other endorsement of an interpretation anywhere else in the Torah by God that is so clear. They are right. They speak correctly. One could say that through God's words, God indirectly says Pinchas was correct, or I appreciate what he did. But this praise for the women is more direct. In each case, God's intention seemed to be carried out, not by Moses, but through interpreting and responding to God's intent, whether it was Pinchas or the daughters of Zelophehad. There was not a direct communication to them as there has been to Moses. So Zornberg highlights the way that the daughters of Zelophehad use interpretation of the law, offering ways to make just distribution of the land when the rules handed down by God are not adequate for this situation. Zornberg points out that as the Israelites are about to enter the Promised Land, they will encounter situations not covered in Torah, just like today we encounter issues that have not been addressed by the Constitution, let's say. The daughters of Zelophehad are leading the way in interpreting the law, offering their interpretation when no precise law exists for them to follow. What I found most surprising about Zornberg's commentary was her description of Moses being limited in his power of interpretation. Moses depends on direct communication from God. He was chosen to be this vessel, this channel for God's direct intention. Moses never developed the capacity to interpret, to write commentary. Suddenly, what we all see is Moses' great power, his ability to hear directly the word of God, also appears oddly as a limitation. He has to consult God directly rather than interpret Torah. And this limitation is perhaps one more reason why his style of leadership will no longer be appropriate in the Promised Land. The story demonstrates that the word of God will have to be interpreted by the next generation when Moses is no longer the direct voice of God. And God is giving his blessing to the five sisters, is making a correct interpretation. And this is how it will be forever after. We, like the five sisters, have to interpret the law because we can't count on the voice of God to answer us. So I hope this reading of the story inspires us to make our own interpretations that are appropriate for us in our times. So we will continue our dialogues and stories, asking questions of our teachers and each other, making interpretations and knowing in our hearts that no questions will be answered. And that is perfectly wonderful.